ICJ by a country that is not one of the parties involved in the conflict, because one thinks most recently of the case of Russia and Ukraine, which Ukraine brought, or in fact the first genocide case that was heard at the International Court of Justice, which of course had to do with Srebrenica, the genocide of Bosnians in the Yugoslavia war.
Yes. So primarily, the court can deal with any issues. Issues of genocide, of course, there've not been many cases of genocide brought before the court. In this particular case, however, both South Africa and Israel are members of the UN. They've both signed on to the Genocide Convention, and as a result of their membership of the UN and signature of the Genocide Convention, may be held responsible and have responsibilities under this convention. And this is the reason which established South Africa's grounds for filing the case. There have been other cases brought against member states who are not, who have not signed the Genocide Convention. Those cases are more difficult. It is more difficult in particular to try and enforce any findings or to establish jurisdiction of the court in order to look into those cases. But the court may still make preliminary findings, may make other findings, which are and can be very useful in trying to protect individuals who are being affected by genocide and actions connected to genocide.
And so if you could begin, Kajal, just by explaining, of course, the decision, as everyone has said, is likely to take years on the case itself, on the merits. What are the provisional measures that South Africa is calling for in the interim?
Yes. So essentially what South Africa is calling for is a ceasefire in Gaza. They've set this out in a number of ways. They're asking for the blockade in Gaza to cease immediately. They're asking for the seizure of the bombings and the actions which are causing the death of killing of Palestinians, destruction of their homes, expulsion, displacement, blockade on food, water, medical assistance, as well as the imposition of measures preventing Palestinian births by destroying essential health services, which are crucial for the survival of pregnant women and babies. And these are all listed as genocidal actions in the suit. So there's a whole range of actions which they're calling for an immediate cease on. And these are the provisional measures which South Africa seeks at the current time.
Maha Abdullah, you are a Palestinian genocide scholar. Can you explain the significance of this going to the International Court of Justice and the how people are responding in Israel and Palestine?
Thank you for having me. This is a historic moment for the Palestinian people in their pursuit for justice and accountability. Decades after the imposition of a settler colonial and apartheid regime against the Palestinian people that has dispossessed and fragmented the Palestinians without accountability and with near total impunity. So the fact that Israel today stands on trial is very significant, very important. But of course, we recognize the possibilities and the different scenarios that are forthcoming. And the fact that Israel is on trial for the crime of genocide is also significant, because as the application of the South Africa before the International Court of Justice states, that the crime of genocide and the alleged genocidal acts and omissions by the State of Israel are part of a continuum. They do not happen in a vacuum. They're part and parcel of the ongoing Nakba imposed on the Palestinian people. And for that, there needs to be accountability. As for the reactions, unfortunately, I have not yet been able to interact with many people. The hearing session just finished. But I know that most of us Palestinians, whether in Palestine or in diaspora or in exile, we have been waiting for this moment. And all eyes have been on the ICJ, on The Hague today. And we have been thinking about the Palestinians in Gaza and how they perceive the current hearing sessions. more than 90 days after complete devastation, more than 90 days after significant and extreme and severe loss, destruction and pain inflicted on the Palestinians there for the purpose of the destruction of the group. And of course, we think of Palestinians in exile who have been also mentioned by the South African ambassador in his introductory remarks when he spoke about the denial, the deliberate denial of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination, which includes the right of return for Palestinians in refugee camps across the neighboring countries.
So let me just turn, Maha, thank you for that, to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who spoke Wednesday, one day before today's hearing, at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, responding to the hearing.
I want to make a few points absolutely clear. Israel has no intention of permanently occupying Gaza or displacing its civilian population. Israel is fighting Hamas terrorists, not the Palestinian population. And we are doing so in full compliance with international law. The IDF is doing its utmost to minimize civilian casualties, while Hamas is doing its utmost to maximize them by using Palestinian civilians as human shields. The IDF urges Palestinian civilians to leave war zones by disseminating leaflets, making phone calls, providing safe passage corridors, while Hamas prevents Palestinians from leaving at gunpoint and often with gunfire. Our goal is to rid Gaza of Hamas terrorists and free our hostages. Once this is achieved, Gaza can be demilitarized and de-radicalized, thereby creating a possibility for a better future for Israel and Palestinians alike.
So that was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Maha, if you could respond to what he said regarding the case that is now ongoing at the International Court of Justice.
I think this is a baseless statement and the statements over the past 13 weeks plus and even prior to the 7th of October have been genocidal in intent, showcased how Israeli political leaders, Israeli military leaders have this specific intent for aiming for the destruction of the Palestinian people using different means and methods through different policies, practices, laws, military orders. And the fact that there has been an apartheid regime imposed for 75 years, along with a belligerent occupation for 56 years, a blockade and closure on the Gaza Strip, and the incarceration of an entire people as well. These are all precursors and drivers of genocide. And the genocidal statements that we've been hearing since 13 weeks now cannot be simply put aside or disregarded by a simple statement the night before the hearing session start at the ICJ.
Could you explain, what do you hope will come out of this, knowing that, of course, a decision may take several years, but there could be these provisional measures that are put in place, even though they're not, in fact, enforceable. The court does not have the capacity to enforce the measures.
The most and foremost important thing to come out of this from this application and these proceedings at the moment is for the court to order Israel to stop its aggression, to stop its hostilities, to stop its military operations against the Gaza Strip. And this is particularly important considering the severity, the scale and the gravity of the situation in the Gaza Strip, but also the failure of the international system, of the international community, to come to a consensus and to order Israel at the UN Security Council, but also in other spheres, to push it to put an end to this genocidal aggression against the Palestinians. And as you said, the merits of the case, the actual decision of whether there is genocide or not by the court will take years. But for the moment, what is mostly important is a need to stop this genocidal aggression, to safeguard and to protect whatever is possible to save at this moment of Palestinian life, of Palestinian dignity, and of Palestinian rights.
Kanjal Ramjathan Keo, I wanted to ask you about Hamas. It is a non-state player here. How does it fit into this decision? And also, because there isn't enforcement, What is the role particularly of the United States, since it sits on the UN Security Council, which, of course, is related to the International Court of Justice as a UN body?
Yes. The South African legal team set out very clearly the position of Hamas in this particular matter. And what they said in their submissions was that the International Court of Justice is there to adjudicate matters and cases between states. Hamas is not a state, and therefore Hamas is not part of this application. No claims have been brought against Hamas, and no claims can be brought against Hamas at this particular tribunal. There are other tribunals in which Hamas can be, crimes against Hamas can be brought, but this is not the appropriate tribunal for that particular issue. So that deals with the issue of Hamas. Talking about the US and their involvement in this case, the US, as we know, are longtime friends with Israel. If there is In the event that there is a final decision made by the court and the court makes findings on genocide and genocidal intent against Israel, of course, there is no immediate obligation on Israel to act on these findings, and we don't expect Israel to comply with these findings, which will then lead to the matter being presented to the UN Security Council to try and enforce this compliance. And at that point, with the US being a permanent member of the Security Council, they could, of course, use their veto powers to block any actions against Israel. So that would be a very serious challenge related to compliance of any findings of this court.
Well, Kajal, apart from the UN Security Council, of course, the person who leads the International Court of Justice, of the 15 judges, the president is an American, Joan Donahue, and the vice president is a Russian, Kirill Gavorgian. So if you could say, I mean, ostensibly the judges are supposed to be impartial, but in the most recent case last year with Russia and Ukraine, the only countries to abstain from the vote, which was otherwise 13 people voted for Russia withdrawing from Ukraine, the provisional measure, China and Russia were the only two who did not. So if you could say, just in terms of precedence, do judges more or less make decisions that coincide with the policies of their countries, or is it the case that this is an exception?
Yes, so judges are supposed to be independent. We expect judges to be independent. Judicial independence is the cornerstone of all democracies. We require judicial independence to be able to support us and support us to claim our rights and to claim our democracies. It's a means, it's a hugely important means of protection. We've seen previously at the ICJ in the Ukraine v. Russia case, both the Russian and the Chinese judges offered dissenting opinions. I would very much hope that the American judge, the president of the court, does feel an obligation to be independent, properly independent in this matter. How there is, of course, no guarantee of this. There is very little which can be done in the event of the American judge dissenting, making findings which are not in line with the majority of the court. And this is a this is essentially the problem of the International Court of Justice, in that it can take on a relatively political slant in the decisions which it issues.
And now their terms are up. The American, she has had a number of positions at the State Department before, Joan Donahue, are up in February. So they could be up before this decision is released. Is that right, Kajal?
I'm not aware of when her term is up, so I can't really comment on that. But the fact that she's sitting on the issue of provisional measures means that she will have some impact on what happens as the court makes findings on provisional measures. And if, however, the court decides to go into the merits of the case and proceeds with the matter, then she will no longer sit on the case going forward, but we don't know who will replace her. So that's an unknown, but it's not guaranteed that there won't be U.S. influence on the case going forward.
So, Maha Abdullah, just as we wrap up, if you could just give us your final thoughts, your assessment of what the situation is right now in Gaza, what you hope will come out of this.
Again, as I mentioned, I hope that this, following the hearing sessions and on the basis of precedent by the very same court where it has issued provisional measures within days or weeks time on, let's say, similar cases, but not entirely alike, that the court will order the state of Israel to stop its aggression, to stop its military operations against the Gaza Strip and its people. The Gaza Strip, as we've seen, that there's large scale destruction, extensive killings taking place, ongoing and relentless bombardment and killings that are taking place. The catastrophe is so immense that we're unable to understand or comprehend between the starvation and dehydration, the lack of medical facilities and accessibility to medical supplies, to the most basic necessities for life in dignity and for life and survival, even together with the fact that it's under a total siege, blockade and closure that has intensified since the 7th of October, the mass displacement and forcible displacement and transfer of more than 1.9 million Palestinians into areas that are also being targeted and bombed by Israel and its military. All of these require immediate action, and immediate action that should not have taken place today or yesterday, but 3 months ago. So this is, we don't have time. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and in the entirety of Palestine, we do not have the privilege of time. So this is why the court, the proceedings before the court, as rightly stated by South Africa in its application, they are of extreme urgency. So the court must immediately act and respond to the urgent situation, again, against the backdrop of the failure of the international system and the international justice mechanisms, as well as the complicity, the open-ended complicity and support emboldening Israel's action, emboldening Israel's atrocities and recurrence and intensification of these violations and grave breaches and international crimes being committed against the Palestinian people.
Maha Abdullah, I want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian genocide scholar speaking to us from Jerusalem, and Kajal Ramjathan Kilo, South African human rights lawyer, speaking to us from Johannesburg. Next up, an exclusive report in The Guardian revealing how carbon emissions from Israel's war on Gaza will have an immense effect on the climate crisis. Back in 20 seconds.
أعلى من الصاروخ ناموا خافوا عالسفح أعلى من البحر عالسفح أعلى من الصاروخ ناموا خافوا وطار الحمام طار الحمام طار الحمام طار الحمام عالسفح أعلى من البحر عالسفح أعلى من السروب نام خافوا
عالسفح by Issa Boulos. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
In an exclusive story this week, The Guardian's climate justice reporter Nina Lakhani revealed that, quote, the planet warming emissions generated during the first 2 months of the war in Gaza were greater than the annual carbon footprint of more than 20 of the world's most climate vulnerable nations, end quote. The report is based on new work by researchers in the U.S. and the U.K., and they say even this impact is likely an underestimate. The analysis includes carbon emissions from fuel for aircraft, tanks, and other vehicles, as well as emissions from making and exploding bombs, artillery, and rockets. It also showed that U.S. cargo planes flying military supplies to Israel accounted for nearly half of all the carbon emissions.
For more, we're joined in New York by Nina Lakhani, senior climate justice reporter for The Guardian. Her story is headlined, Emissions from Israel's War in Gaza Have Immense Effect on Climate Catastrophe. Also with us in Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank is Hadil Ikhmais, who's featured in the report, is the head of the Climate Change Office at the Palestinian Environmental Quality Authority, their office based in Ramallah. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Nina Lakhani, lay out exactly what you found.
So the researchers in the UK and US, what they did is it's the first attempt to calculate the carbon impact, the greenhouse gas impact of the war in Gaza. So so information about militaries and about war is very hard to come by because governments don't release this data themselves. So what they did is for the first 60 days, they looked at all the publicly available information that they could corroborate, including Hamas rockets, the air missions, the ground attacks in Gaza by Israel, and what they've calculated is like a really conservative estimate of the carbon dioxide emissions just in the first 60 days. What they also did is they looked at sort of gave us a snapshot of the occupation. So they looked at the carbon impact of the Hamas tunnels, which have been constructed since 2007, 2008, and Israel's Iron Wall. And they also provided an estimate of the reconstruction costs. So the conservative estimate they've used is that 100,000 buildings have been destroyed in Gaza so far. And the amount of carbon dioxide that will be generated through the reconstruction of those buildings, if that is allowed to go ahead in the coming years.
Hadil Ikhmais, you spoke to Nina for this Guardian report, and you told her, and I'm quoting, among all the problems facing the state of Palestine in the coming decades, climate change is the most immediate and certain, and this has been amplified by the occupation and war on Gaza since the 7th of October. So, Hadil, if you could lay out what were the climate crises that Gaza was confronted with, that Palestine was confronted with, that have now been exacerbated by this now almost 3 month long war?
Well, we've done through the last years before even becoming a part of the UNFCCC in 2016, we've made a lot of research and a lot of studies to find the climate scenarios. And after joining the UNFCCC and ratifying and signing Paris Agreement, Palestine had three very worst, we call them the bad, the worst, and the worst scenarios of climate action in Palestine regarding the heat waves, the drought, the high unprecedented temperature, the dryness in the rainy season, and also all these fluctuations of fluctuations and the rainfall and the temperatures and the increasing of the heat and a warm period and the decreasing and the in the colder periods, all of this will make a transformation to the way of life to the Palestinian from securing the water and also the food security. Because Palestine is an agricultural country which relies on the agriculture sector, mainly the olive and livestock, as the first income. So all these fluctuations and all these climate scenarios will negatively impact the livelihood and the basic needs of the life of livelihood in Palestinians in both West Bank and Gaza. And we've done assessment to both the high priority sectors that are vulnerable to the climate action in both West Bank and Gaza. And these are 12 sectors, among them the water and the food security, with occupation line by line on the land in the West Bank and Gaza will exacerbate the problem by make it very difficult for the Palestinians to adapt and to be vulnerable to these changes. For example, the land confiscation, the water resources restriction, the abstraction from the groundwater, the zero shares from the surface waters to the Palestinians. Hadil, also,
Hadil, I wanted to ask you about the impact that comes from Israel's destruction of renewable energy projects in Gaza. Can you explain what they are?
Yeah, this is true, and this is very. We've been working through the last 10 years on finding energy security resources and water resources from unconventional ways. For example, wastewater treatment, desalination in Gaza, a lot of renewable energy, solar panels, in order to find another resources to Palestinian in Gaza. But with all these, and they are in different shapes. For example, there are big projects, small projects, some entrepreneurship, some small projects for small villages or neighborhoods. All of these, or basically most of them, were being destructed from the airstrikes and from the war and the last bombardment. Among them, one big project from the world, funded from the World Bank and also from the Ministry of Finance in Palestine, most of these solar panels were destructed. And also we have another project with the Green Climate Fund, which is the financial arm to the UNFCCC, which is called the Water Banking in North Gaza. Also, we don't know how is the exact damage of this facility because there's a lack of communication between the technical team in West Bank and Gaza because of the war because technical persons and colleagues are under war. So we don't know how much is the real damage to these facilities. But all the reports from different organizations, from the WHO, from the UNICEF, from a lot of international organizations show that there are a lot of facilities that extremely and mostly damaged because of the airstrikes in different places regarding to water facilities, water pipelines, water energy units, desalination units, wastewater treatment plants, treatment units. All of them were basically partially or completely destructed by the airstrikes. And all of these things make it very challenging against combating climate change because we need those infrastructure to be able to have this adaptive capacity to have water from unconventional resources, energy security, also the health sector that's been targeted by targeting the hospitals and all the main facilities for treatment.
Hadil, I wanted to bring Nina in for the last minute and ask you, we just talked about the International Court of Justice in the case that's been brought before them today. Your recent article on Israel's intent to flood Gaza tunnels was cited by South Africa in their case today. We just have a minute. Can you talk about this?
I mean, I think the targeting, it's been cited as sort of evidence of the collective punishment. You know, there is no life without water and food, and any targeting of water and food resources and supplies, as argued by South Africa, is evidence of genocidal intent. And I think just that article and that work and also the work that we're talking about here regarding the climate impact, you know, it shows that in this situation, the human suffering, the environmental destruction, immediate environmental destruction, and the long-term climate impacts are all interrelated. You know, the carbon emissions may seem very small compared to the global emissions, but they will have a direct impact and an indirect impact on Palestine, on Israel, and all of us globally. And I think that the climate sort of the carbon analysis of war is something that really hasn't been thought about. It's sort of an evolving science and evolving area. But I think as well as immediate environmental destruction regarding, you know, what Hadil's talked about, the sort of targeting of water and food supplies has to be thought as you know, I think the impact on the global climate is something that we should be thinking about alongside that.
We have to leave it there. Nina Lakhani with The Guardian and Hadil Ikhmais, head of the Climate Change Office at the Palestinian Environmental Quality Authority. A happy belated birthday to Claudia Bada. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
If you're a Canadian Indigenous student considering many life choices about your future, Inspire can help. If you need ideas about possible education or career path options specifically for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit folks like you, join Inspire's mentorship program, Rivers to Success. It's free to register, and you'll get plenty of up-to-the-minute information about university, college, and vocational trade schools. Most importantly, again, it's free. It's free, it's free, it's free. It's online, and we have monthly events with prizes. Discover the many potential job and study opportunities that are waiting for you across Turtle Island. Register online now at rivers2success.ca. Again, that's rivers2success.ca.